that book. Today, it's a real honor to have Anne Winblad, co-founder and managing director of Hummer Winblad Venture Partners, one of the premier firms in Silicon Valley, with us. Anne, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
So, folks, Anne is a legend in our business. You will hear a lot of whining about bias against women in the industry, but I've never, ever heard Anne whine about any of that. She is successful in her own right as a venture capitalist, and she is the most successful venture capitalist, female venture capitalist in the industry. So I am thrilled to have Anne with us, and we're going to have a conversation in general about what she sees in the industry and in cloud computing in particular, but in general as well. And then we'll talk about some of the issues vis-a-vis women and entrepreneurship and venture capital and all that. And then, you know, we'll kick around whatever else comes up. So, Anne, let's start off with getting a sense of what you've been in the industry for a long time. You've seen the full evolution from, the 90s all the way till now. Where are we in the history of entrepreneurship, history of venture-funded entrepreneurship? Where are we going?
Well, I started my career as an entrepreneur myself. I started my first company the same year that Microsoft started, and that was a long time ago, in 1976. That was a seminal time for company creation. Apple started shortly after that. Oracle started about that time as well. It seemed even at that point in time that at the beginning of the PC industry, which was the creation of these companies and mini computers, but in the case of Oracle, that we pretty much discovered everything. But today we're at a really interesting place for technology and for entrepreneurship. And we talk about it as web scale infrastructure. And that web scale infrastructure is globalized. It is commoditized at the developer level, meaning that the cost of building a company is far less than it was even for me, where I had to go out and buy some computers that cost about $25,000 each, and those were PCs for my developers. And as a result, there's an explosion of innovation globally, both at the enterprise level and the consumer level. We are seeing this creation happen in Silicon Valley specifically, in the U.S., $30 billion of venture capital this year, with about 60% of that going to California. So here it is still the Mesopotamia of company creation. But the rest of the world is doing pretty well as well. I just came back from Stockholm, where they've had a number of billion-dollar exits. In software companies, both consumer and enterprise. I've recently been to Berlin, the same situation there. Most of our companies are global. One of our largest companies here in San Francisco, MuleSoft, which is web scale integration for the enterprise, has several hundred people in Buenos Aires. So it's quite exciting to see the ability for any entrepreneur to start a company, the capital creation being part of this web scale infrastructure with crowdfunding platforms, and entrepreneurs believing that if they are successful, not just here in the U.S., but in other places in the world, that they should give part of their earnings back to creating other entrepreneurs. So we're at a very flourishing time for both technology and for entrepreneurs.
So, Anne, what is your personal investment thesis today as a venture capitalist? What kinds of opportunities are you looking for to invest in? What sectors, what types of businesses?
We are what's called a focused fund, meaning that we do have specific strategies that we use for investing. We start all of our investments at the A round. That means that many companies that come to us have no capital or seed capital. We invest in all business-to-business opportunities. and primarily those are aimed at the enterprise. And at the enterprise at two levels, at the core software infrastructure, that would include development tools, the data center infrastructure, integration, security, and then on top of that, we have always been investors in analytics, and that theme is going quite well right now because we are seeing in this web scale infrastructure era that data is playing an even bigger role.
So you talked about MuleSoft. Let's actually take a couple of your companies and drill down and understand kind of your thinking behind why you invested in those opportunities. Obviously, today these are big successes, but when you invested, that was not so clear. So you must have made a certain analysis of those businesses. What was that thought process, and how has that evolved over time in terms of their execution, and what has caused the successes to happen? What can we learn from that?
Well, there's three things to learn. First, how did we find this company in the beginning, or how did the company find us? Every entrepreneur wants to know that.
Absolutely.
Because we're focused on the enterprise, we keep a very strong relationship with all of the analysts who cover the enterprise. Mm-hmm. And in this case, analyst by the name of Jason Maynard, who had covered the enterprise for a number of investment banking firms, called me up and said, "Ann, I cover the traditional companies, IBM, Oracle, TIBCO, and this name keeps coming up, MuleSoft. And I've done some investigative work myself, and it's one of those new open source companies. So maybe you should take a look at them." And here's the guy's name, Ross Mason. And that's called a trusted source for a venture capitalist. It could be another one of my colleagues who calls me up, an entrepreneur that we funded before, and we jump on those opportunities in front of anything that comes directly to us without an introduction. So having yourself be discoverable by an influencer is really important for an entrepreneur early on. I reached out to this entrepreneur, and I was a little shocked to find that he lived in Malta, and I had to admit to myself that I didn't exactly know where I knew generally where Malta was, but not specifically. So he happened to be visiting the States and had one co-founder here. There was a new category called open source, and this is really indicative of today's companies. Yeah. About 150,000 copies of an enterprise services bus. This is something that traditionally you had professional services coming into large companies, but large companies had downloaded this software. One company had built their trading platform. One major airline had built their reservation system. One pharmaceutical firm had built their back-end infrastructure without having anyone appear at their company. It was a testament to the quality of the software. Mm-hmm. As an enterprise service bus is important infrastructure, and also the trend that companies would select by themselves, wanted to service themselves, and were committing to self-service high-quality software. We called those companies, and it was really apparent this was a real big opportunity. At that point in time, which is about 5 years ago, there were only five or six public application programmer interfaces, or APIs. And there probably were maybe 1,000 SaaS companies. Today there are 10,000 SaaS companies. There are tens of thousands of application program interfaces that are published. So the integration problem, there are multiple clouds, there are hybrid clouds. So the integration challenge has magnified, increasing the opportunity for MuleSoft. This company kept true to its mission to provide very, very high quality that customers could self-serve, that they could deploy very, very quickly. It had a community of developers. Some of that community of developers were in Buenos Aires, where we started a development center. And the company has scaled all of these pieces MuleSoft today has just under 500 employees, offices in Buenos Aires, London, Sydney, and San Francisco, where their headquarters are. Ross is still the visionary leader of the company with 499 other visionaries. So it had a very strong mission, a very big opportunity. It had proven the opportunity without any capital, and it has kept very, very high standards along the way on hiring, maintaining the culture, maintaining a global company, maintaining high quality of service and delivery to their customers, very, very low churn on these customers. It entered the market with a brand new business model where software is downloaded, it's subscription revenue, not perpetual licenses, where they really knew that responding to the customer, they had to be agile and fast and continually leverage the community of not just their developers, the customers. And it really has executed extremely well. And the talent we've been able to recruit around Ross has been key to their success. So it's one of those great venture stories so far. They're not all as perfect.
So, Anne, there are a few things you said I want to highlight for our audience because they're very much in tune with the philosophy that we practice in our program, which is, you know, bootstrap first, validate first, and then raise capital. And the MuleSoft story, obviously, as you said, without capital, they had validated and they've got an immense amount of traction. That's definitely something that we heavily promote. The other thing is this whole global phenomenon that's happening around the world. One of the reasons we started 1M1M is to kind of bring Silicon Valley's tribal knowledge to the world and foster this entrepreneurship around the world. And this is not just us. Many organizations are doing that, and we are kind of part of this collective global entrepreneurship movement right now. So it's very encouraging to hear the MuleSoft story that this is, you know, not a company, not a traditional Silicon Valley company that comes out of one of the big firms like a Google or a Facebook and has all inside tracks and et cetera, et cetera. It's basically somebody who came from elsewhere and made a very big success happen. So all of that is very interesting. The third interesting thing that I noted from what you said is Latin America. The rise of Latin America in the software world is an interesting development. We've seen, obviously, India is an old story. India is doing very well. But there is definitely very interesting movement in Latin America right now. And your Buenos Aires story is very interesting from that perspective. Do you have another company that you would like to share with us the story and the analysis on?
Sure. Probably another great story is what's really happening in Canada. One of my partners is named Lars Leckie, and Lars is Canadian Danish. And when he became a partner, he realized, you know, where are the Canadians? So we've funded a few Canadian companies, and in fact, years ago, you would find all the venture capitalists flying to Austin, Texas, and they would call that flight the nerd bird from San Francisco to Austin. The new nerd bird is from San Francisco to Toronto. And Toronto is a very multinational city, as you well know. So we funded a couple companies that originate in Canada. One of them I'm on the board of called Sonotype. It's headquartered in Washington, D.C. And that's another great example of how companies can deliver value first to prove their technical credentials to build a platform for a commercial software deployment and then build a company around it. And this company is called Sonotype. And Sonotype are the caretakers of what's called the central repository. And the central repository is where source code components for specifically for open source and other code libraries are stored. Last year, 13 billion components were downloaded from the central repository. 13
wow.
billion. And what that indicates is three things. One is no one sits around and handwrites code anymore. They assemble it. And so when we talk about the sharing economy, we think of things like Airbnb and Uber, but we really don't think about how it's increasing the rapid development of software and also the number of new companies we're seeing. Because code is shared, libraries are shared, engineers really have become part of the sharing economy even earlier than we've noticed. Sonatype has then built commercial products on top of this that allows major enterprises to manage the quality of the code, check for component linkages that might create security issues, and those products are called component lifecycle management products. So the concept here is very much the same as Mule at a different level in the enterprise. Mm-hmm. Almost every enterprise, their developers do this, and commercially developers do it as well. So it's one of the impacts we're seeing here in this sharing economy is the rapidity of company creation. We're looking for companies that participate in this in multiple ways. Sonatype, their people build code this way, and also they deliver the tools that allow people to build code. They also delivered another open source product early called Maven, which is the common build tool that all developers use. So in looking at a sharing economy, both as an entrepreneur, you have to look at it at all levels. You know, how do I get leverage when I'm building the code? How do I get leverage to get funded? Today, if we look at the crowdfunding platforms in the U.S., about 9% of the companies that have been able to secure funding on a crowdfunding platform of greater than $100,000 have gone on to receive additional capital.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'd like to jump to that for a minute too. You know, you mentioned you know, women in the tech industry and women entrepreneurs, which you and I are very big supporters of. Only about 7 to 9% of founders that are venture-backed by traditional venture capitalists are women. But on these crowdfunding platforms in the U.S., about 37% of the founders of the companies receiving their seed funding on a crowdfunding platform are women.
Uh-huh.
And also there's more diversity across the United States itself, let alone globally. So, you know, we don't have to depend upon venture capitalists being totally in charge of diversity anymore, or just, you know, as
right.
like say, hope is not a strategy. But these new crowdfunding platforms are changing everything.
Anyway, and I'm glad you segued us in here. You know, part of the what's missing from the analysis, and there is a, I'm a little bit uncomfortable with the level of sensationalization that goes on this issue, because the issue is a lot more complex and actually somewhat scientific than it's made out to be. The truth
yes.
is the venture-funded businesses tend to be more technology-heavy businesses, and there is a lack of people, that lack of women in the technology industry. So it is a function of the fact that there aren't enough people in STEM, enough women in STEM, and then they're not building enough technology companies, whereas the crowdfunding world or the bootstrap entrepreneurship world is full of women because the types of companies are different. You know, e-commerce, you look at e-commerce, there are like hundreds of thousands of e-commerce businesses out there, and many, many, many of them are founded and run by women. It's a very
yeah.
women-heavy category. And the kind of companies that are getting funded by crowdfunding typically are not technology companies, they are other kinds of businesses. And that's, you know, again, it's kind of, it's natural and it's it makes sense that these, you know, women are finding more options in those areas.
Yes,
and then another
I would add one thing there. We don't do direct-to-consumer funding as we're doing the enterprise, but I do have a number of companies that come my way and say, who should I talk to for my direct-to-consumer business? And there's really, you know, when you think about some of the higher profile, you know, that are marketplaces, for example, like Airbnb, you know, many of the customers of Airbnb are women. That was not a woman-created company. Because the bigger companies, even if they're in marketplaces and commerce, to scale, the message I would send to women is they're going to need some technical chops.
Right.
And if they have them themselves, they're going to have an unfair competitive advantage. If they don't hire them early, they'll have a real disadvantage. So at some point in time, when you start a company, there is no customer engagement model today for the future that doesn't involve a digital engagement.
Right.
Major enterprises are transforming their whole enterprise to have new digital customer engagement platforms. So women, even if they do not have STEM majors, if they want to build any business of scale, are going to end up dealing with engineers. So, you know, postgraduate or whatever, it doesn't mean that women need to learn how to code, but they should really figure out, you know, how do I communicate with an engineer? How do I hire an engineer? How do I know if it's a great engineer? How do I get into the digital transformation of society as a whole? So we can't start separating women from technical and non-technical. You know, it's important to communicate to men and women who do not have STEM degrees that they're in a STEM world. They may not be writing code, but if they're going to be that person founding or running a company, they are going to have engineers working for them.
Right. And I'm fully with you on that. In my thesis on the evolution of the web, you know, we have actually in September we released From E-commerce to Web 3.0, another book covering that part of the B2C economy. And really, you know, if you want to do Web 3.0 the way I see it, it's personalization heavy. And personalization can only be done at scale with very serious, you know, data, machine learning, AI kinds of technologies, and you better, if you want to deliver value with a user experience that is heavily personalized, you have to learn all that. And, you know, there is online fashion is a very popular category right now after many, many years. As you know, I started one of the first online fashion companies a long, long time ago, 15 years ago. Now it's a hot category, and it's a category that naturally lends itself to women. Women founders. But I think today to deliver a differentiated user experience, it is not sufficient to know merchandising either. You have to know merchandising, you have to know branding, but you also need technology, and those are the three legs that have to come together in the founding team to deliver a really compelling user experience.
Yeah, everybody should read your book. I mean, it's a great book, and you know, it's very readable by a non-technical person. The reverse of that in the enterprise where we're funding is that every enterprise now realizes that the consumer expectations for engagement are very, very high. A consumer does not want to be treated, nor do your employees, all of your stakeholders want to be treated as a party of one.
Right.
They want to have not just have things sent to them and communicated to them, they want to be dialoguing with you via any device at any time. So it's not just, this has been a very, very rapid change and it's driving many of the technologies we're investing in. And I'll give you a great example here of a company that we funded in Utah fairly recently, about 2 years ago, that also is, it's you know, they're calling companies that grow really fast here unicorn. So it is one of those unicorns. It also is approaching about 350 employees now from, you know, the 2,000 they had when we funded them. And they built a machine learning platform for something very simple, which is inside sales.
Mm-hmm.
Now, inside sales before, I once had a job as a telemarketer for the phone company. and my screen would come up and tell me, make these calls in this order, you know, by this time. And, you know, here's a little bit of information about the customer. And this machine learning platform, which is in the cloud, which tells you also about the compute power that the cloud is able to do right now for young companies. It's a machine learning platform that brings in all sorts of data, including weather. So if I'm sitting down today and I'm an inside sales user at a telemarketing firm, it's probably already has told me that the power's out, there's a horrible storm, people are going to be preoccupied in the Bay Area today, so don't call them. But it also, when it brings me up, if it was a sunny day here, it would say, you know, you should email Ann before 8 o'clock in the morning, I'm giving away a secret here, before she starts, you know, while she's getting all of her work prepared for the day. And don't try to reach her after 8:30 because she's already now in that work stream. And you probably shouldn't phone her, you should, you know, you can text her. This is her engagement model, which is different than the next person's. And, you know, it would also say, look, you know, there's a news event in, you know, in this place and people are going to be distracted by that, not a good time to call them. So it brings in all the external variables as well as the personalization variables to know exactly how and when I should engage with each individual. And it continually learns because it's a machine learning platform. So when we talk about building a digital engagement platform, and even for people that read your book, this is not a fixed target. This is a rapidly moving target. So getting in that learning stream, as you've recommended now, just gets you prepared for putting your head around how rapidly the personalization models and the technology under them and your competitors will be able to respond to customers and engage them, or you become the one that engages with them in their expected ways.
Super, Ann, it's been a great discussion. Thank you for spending half an hour with us today, and hopefully we'll keep, you know, working on stuff together as we go along, and I hope your power comes back soon.
Thank you very much, and thank you for all the great work you do for entrepreneurs. As a venture capitalist, it's, you know, here in the Bay Area, and your reach globally is the reason why we have so many great companies. So thank you very much.
Thanks for coming in.